Are you okay? It's okay not to be okay. Kids Help Phone is available 24/7, so you don't have to deal with your feelings alone. You can text with a volunteer crisis responder or call a professional counselor. Visit kidshelpphone.ca for more info.
Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
I have seen so much malnutrition here. I've seen it in the pregnancies that we see. I've seen it in the babies that come out. I've seen it walking through the emergency room with the kids and the men and women. So I see it everywhere. I see it in the staff who every day talk about how hungry they are.
Gaza officials say Israel's killed at least 111 Palestinians over the past 24 hours, including 91 seeking food and aid. We'll speak with a doctor just back from Gaza. Meanwhile, Israel's blaming the United Nations for withholding aid to Gaza.
This is a monument to the catastrophic failure of the United Nations to deliver aid into Gaza. Hundreds upon hundreds of pallets of aid just rotting in the sun instead of being delivered to the people who need it.
We'll get an update on UN aid efforts in Gaza from Julia Tuma, spokesperson for UNRWA, the UN Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees. And finally, as Trump's tariff deadline looms, where do things stand on trade agreements?
August 1st is a very big day for this country because money is going to pour into the United States like we've never seen before.
Trump hits India with 25% tariffs and Brazil with 50% tariffs for putting his ally, former President Bolsonaro, on trial for attempting a coup in Brazil. Trump also threatened Canada's trade deal for backing a Palestinian state. We'll speak with Lori Wallach, director of Rethink Trade. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Officials in Gaza say Israel's killed at least 111 Palestinians over the past 24 hours, including 91 people seeking food and aid. Over 800 Palestinians have been injured. In the deadliest incident on Wednesday, at least 51 were killed by Israeli forces as they headed toward aid trucks at the Zikim crossing. On Wednesday, Palestinians gathered at Al-Shifa Hospital to mourn the deaths of family and friends killed on Tuesday while seeking aid.
You can ask anyone. For 3 or 4 days, you couldn't find any food. People were either dying of hunger, even in intensive care units, you find them starving with nothing to eat. Or we would die in the places of death, the places of killing and destruction, where we go to get something to eat but end up bringing back our children to bury them.
On Wednesday, Canada became the latest country to announce plans to recognize a Palestinian state, joining recent calls by France and the UK. Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney spoke in Ottawa.
Canada intends to recognize the state of Palestine at the 80th session of the United Nations General Assembly in September 2025. This intention is predicated on the Palestinian Authority's commitment to much-needed reforms, including commitments by the Palestinian Authority's President Abbas to fundamentally reform its governance, to hold general elections in 2026 in which Hamas can play no part, and to demilitarize the Palestinian state.
Israel blasted Canada's move, calling it a, quote, reward for Hamas. President Trump wrote on Truth Social, quote, that will make it very hard for us to make a trade deal with them, unquote. Meanwhile, Trump's special envoy, Steve Witkoff, has arrived in Israel as ceasefire talks have stalled. In the UK, a high court has ruled the co-founder of the direct action group Palestine Action can challenge the Home Secretary's decision to ban the group as a terrorist organization. Under the ban, membership and direct support of Palestine Action is punishable by up to 14 years in prison. Since it was banned, more than 200 people have been arrested for publicly protesting in support of Palestine Action. That includes an 83-year-old priest and an 81-year-old retired magistrate judge. Meanwhile, the Board of Deputies of British Jews, the largest organization representing Jews in the UK, has called for a, quote, massive and sustained flow of aid into Gaza. The organization also condemned Israel's starving of the population of the besieged strip. It comes as Prime Minister Keir Starmer announced the UK will recognize a Palestinian state unless Israel agrees to a ceasefire. On Capitol Hill, more than half the Democratic caucus voted Wednesday to block $675 million in U.S. arms sales to Israel. Senator Bernie Sanders had introduced the measure, which ended up being defeated in a 70-27 vote. Senator Sanders spoke from the floor before the vote.
The United States has provided more than $22 billion for Israel's military operations since this war began. $22 billion. One estimate based on Brown University research calculates that the United States has paid for 70% of the Gaza war. In other words, American taxpayer dollars are being used to starve children, bomb schools, kill civilians, and support the cruelty of Netanyahu and his criminal ministers.
The U.S. has sanctioned Alexandre de Moraes, the Brazilian Supreme Court justice, in charge of the criminal case against the right-wing former President Jair Bolsonaro, accused of attempting a coup after losing the 2022 elections. The U.S. also slapped Brazil with 50% tariffs on imports. President Trump signed an executive order announcing the tariffs, specifically citing the justice for abusing, quote, his judicial authority to target political opponents, unquote. President Trump has expressed his admiration for Bolsonaro in the past, calling his trial a witch hunt. Bolsonaro is often referred to as the Trump of the tropics. In other trade news, Trump has announced 25% tariffs on India and new penalties against India for purchasing Russian oil. Trump also announced a new trade deal with South Korea, setting the tariff rate at 15%. We'll have more on Trump's trade deals later in the broadcast. After a historic trial, former Colombian president, close U.S. ally Álvaro Uribe, has been convicted of witness tampering and bribery. He'll be sentenced Friday and faces up to 12 years in prison. The case centered on efforts by Uribe to bribe and imprison members of paramilitary groups to retract damaging testimony exposing his ties to right-wing paramilitary groups. Uribe ruled Colombia from 2002 to 2010. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio criticized Uribe's conviction. In Texas, Republican state lawmakers have formally introduced a plan to redraw Texas's congressional districts with the goal of picking up five more Republican seats. The Texas Republican Party has called the effort a, quote, essential step to preserving GOP control in Congress, unquote. Democratic Congressmember Greg Kassar said the GOP gerrymandering will result in the, quote, illegal voter suppression of Black and Latino Texans. Under the plan, Kassar's district would be redrawn. Meanwhile, California's Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom is pushing to counter Texas by redrawing California's congressional maps to add more Democratic seats. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent has admitted a new Trump plan to create savings accounts for newborns is actually a backdoor way to privatize Social Security. Bessent made the comment Wednesday during a forum organized by the right-wing news outlet Breitbart.
I'm not sure when the distribution level date should be, whether should it be 30 and you can buy a house, should it be 60. But in a way, it is a backdoor for privatizing Social Security.
Democratic Senator Jeanne Shaheen of New Hampshire responded by saying, quote, they're already ripping health care away from millions on Medicaid, and now they've made it clear that your Social Security is next, unquote. In other economic news, the Federal Reserve voted Wednesday to hold interest rates steady, defying pressure from President Trump, who visited the Fed last week to personally lobby for lower rates. In a rare move, two Republicans on the Fed dissented, expressing support for lowering rates. During a news conference, Fed Chair Jerome Powell emphasized the importance of the Fed remaining independent. Trump has repeatedly publicly attacked Powell, calling him a total and complete moron and a numbskull, as well as a disaster. A Senate committee has advanced a bill banning stock trading by members of Congress, the president and the vice president. President Trump slammed the lone Republican who voted for the bill, Missouri Senator Josh Hawley, calling him a, quote, second-tier senator, unquote. That's despite a carve-out Hawley added to the bill that would exclude President Trump. The bill would require elected officials to divest from their stocks at the beginning of their next term and would apply to the president and the vice president starting in 2029. The bill faces steep odds in the Republican-controlled Senate. Harvard's prepared to pay up to $500 million to settle two federal lawsuits brought by the Trump administration. That's according to The New York Times, which reports the emerging deal would unfreeze billions of dollars of frozen funds for research grants and contracts while preserving Harvard's ability to enroll international students. This comes just days after Columbia University agreed to a $221 million settlement after Trump threatened to cut off federal funding, accusing administrators of failing to protect Jewish students against anti-Semitism during campus protests against Israel's assault on Gaza. Meanwhile, Brown University said Wednesday it's agreed to a $50 million settlement that'll restore federal funding for medical research. Brown agreed to comply with the Trump administration's demands to end the consideration of race in its admissions policies. It'll also enforce a ban on transgender athletes in women's sports. Meanwhile, the Trump administration's freezing $108 million in federal research funding to Duke University after determining its affirmative action policies constitute racial discrimination. In California, immigration officials at San Francisco International Airport have detained a South Korean-born researcher and longtime permanent resident for the past week without explanation and without access to a lawyer. Taehyung Will Kim moved to the U.S. when he was just 5 years old. He's a doctoral candidate at Texas A&M University, where he's working on a vaccine to prevent Lyme disease. He was detained July 21st after returning from a two-week trip to South Korea to attend his brother's wedding. A federal appeals court has rejected the Trump administration's bid to rearrest Columbia University graduate Palestinian activist Mahmoud Khalil while the government appeals his release on bail. Wednesday's ruling by the Third Circuit Court of Appeals also affirms a lower court ruling that the Trump administration cannot seek to deport Khalil over his lawful First Amendment-protected speech in support of Palestinian rights. Mahmoud Khalil is a U.S. permanent resident married to a U.S. citizen. New York's Democratic mayoral nominee, Sohrab Mamdani, is calling for a nationwide ban on assault rifles, like the one used by the gunman who opened fire Monday on the Manhattan high-rise that houses the NFL's headquarters. After returning from Uganda, where he celebrated his wedding, Mamdani visited the Bronx home of Didarul Islam, the New York police officer who was killed in Monday's mass shooting. Speaking to reporters after meeting with Islam's family, Mamdani distanced himself from a call he made in 2020 to defund the police and accused his opponents of politicizing the shooting.
And what I would also say in this moment is that it is beyond me that politicians are looking to use these days to score such cynical political points. On the very day that I held the father of Officer Islam in my arms, as he could not utter a single word, and as I felt him sobbing at the memory of his 36-year-old son, who will never come home.
Ukrainian officials say Russian drones and missiles struck the capital Kyiv overnight, killing at least 8 people, wounding dozens of others, including a 6-year-old boy. Russia's attack came hours after Ukraine's parliament voted to restore the independence of two anti-corruption agencies following widespread protests and pressure from European officials. Thousands demonstrated in the streets after President Zelensky's ruling party tried to push amendments that would have allowed his administration to transfer cases away from the agencies. And Israel's release released U.S. labor activist Chris Smalls and the Tunisian activist Hatem Ayouini. They had been detained on Saturday with 19 others with the Freedom Flotilla Coalition when Israeli forces raided their Gaza-bound aid ship, the Handala, in international waters. Earlier this week, the Freedom Flotilla Coalition revealed Smalls had been beaten in Israeli detention. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. Palestinian health officials in Gaza say Israeli attacks have killed at least 111 people and injured more than 800 others just in the past 24 hours. Among the dead are 91 people killed while seeking aid. Meanwhile, Al Jazeera reports a young Palestinian man from Rafah has died from starvation, the 155th hunger-related death since Israel began its assault and siege on Gaza nearly 2 years ago. This week, the world's leading hunger monitoring system warned the, quote, worst-case scenario of famine is playing out in the Gaza Strip with widespread starvation, malnutrition, and disease due to Israel's siege. The Integrated Food Security Phase classification warns the only path to stopping further deaths and catastrophic human suffering is for Israel to allow for the unimpeded, large-scale flow of humanitarian aid into Gaza. As Gaza's starvation crisis grows deeper for more than 2 million Palestinians living under Israel's siege, Republicans in the U.S. Congress are seeking to tighten a ban on the United Nations agency that until recently delivered humanitarian aid to Palestinians. Last week, the Republican-dominated House Appropriations Committee voted in favor of a package to slash foreign aid programs while tightening a financial blockade on the UN Reliefs and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees in the Near East, known as UNRWA. Until Israel banned its operations in January, UNRWA was the main distributor of humanitarian aid in Gaza.
This is former Israeli spokesperson Elon Levy in a video posted this week on X, blaming the United Nations for withholding aid to Gaza.
This is a monument to the catastrophic failure of the United Nations to deliver aid into Gaza. Hundreds upon hundreds of pallets of aid just rotting in the sun instead of being delivered to the people who need it.
For more, we begin today's show with UNRWA's Director of Communications, Juliet Tuma, speaking to us from Amman, Jordan. Juliet, thanks for joining us. Can you respond to Israel saying it's UNRWA, it's the United Nations that's stopping the flow of aid into Gaza?
Yeah, thanks for having me on. Look, for UNRWA, we have 6,000 trucks waiting for the green light, except they're not at Gaza's borders. They are in Jordan, where I am today, and they are in Egypt, loaded with medicines, food, and hygiene supplies. We've been waiting for a green light to start the wheels of those trucks for nearly 5 months now.
So could you describe, Juliet, what is the situation in Gaza, and when was the last time that UNRWA employees, former employees, international employees, were able to get in to the territory? Israel has been denying visas, we understand, for UNRWA employees.
We have 10,000 local Palestinian staff who work with UNRWA. They are spread across the Gaza Strip. They hold the fort while the international staff of the agency are banned from going into the war-torn enclave. They are the doctors and the nurses that keep our medical points open. They're the ones who are able to distribute whatever we have left of basic supplies. They're the drivers, and they're the emergency operators who keep the shelters for the displaced families open. But we got to get in so that we can support them, and we got to get those trucks that are stranded in Jordan and Egypt in Gaza so that together we can distribute to starving people in the Gaza Strip.
And Juliet, for people who aren't familiar, if you could just outline the range of services that UNRWA used to provide within Gaza, the kind of humanitarian aid that was provided, and who's doing that now?
Sure. So before the war, the agency UNRWA was providing schooling and education to over 300,000 boys and girls who went to United Nations schools in the Gaza Strip. We also had over 20 clinics that provided primary health care to patients in the Gaza Strip. And we also gave, even before the war, because the humanitarian situation was already dire, we provided food for about a million people in Gaza. We do something similar in the occupied West Bank. But since the war began, we've shifted gears to do more humanitarian work. We sadly had to close the schools. And as a result, soon in September, the children of Gaza would have been deprived of schooling for a third year in a row.
I wanted to ask you about a recent New York Times article that revealed, quote, according to two senior Israeli military officials, the Israeli military found no proof that Hamas was stealing aid provided by the United Nations. Israel has used these accusations for the past 2 years to restrict food and medical supplies from entering Gaza. Can you talk about the significance of this?
Oh, it's very significant. Thanks for bringing it up. And there was also a report from USAID that came out also a few days ago along the same line. And basically, you're absolutely right. This is a claim that the Israeli government and authorities and those who support them have repeated without any evidence that the humanitarian assistance that the United Nations was bringing in was diverted to Palestinian armed groups, which is absolutely baseless. And these two reports are a proof to that. Those claims were used simply to undermine the work of the United Nations, especially UNRWA. And we all know the disaster of this setup that the American and Israeli governments have put in place and the lives that organization has taken while claiming it provides food for people.
And Juliet, just finally, before we end, I just want to read from a statement that the head of UNRWA, Philippe Lazzarini, made. This is quoting colleagues of yours in Gaza who say that the people in Gaza, quote, are neither dead nor alive. They're walking corpses. So if you could say, Juliet, what are you calling for now?
We're calling for the siege to be lifted. We are calling for a standard and up volume flow of humanitarian assistance managed by the United Nations, including UNRWA. We're calling for a ceasefire. We are calling for the release of all hostages held in Gaza.
Juliet Tuma, we want to thank you very much for being with us, Director of Communications for UNRWA, speaking to us from Amman, Jordan. When we come back, a doctor just back from Gaza joins us in our New York studio. Stay with us. On the Mountains by Nora Brown and Natalie Coleman under Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Mimi Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
As we continue our coverage of Gaza, a Palestinian medical organization reports Israeli forces are increasingly abducting doctors across Gaza, with some 28 doctors currently held in Israeli prisons. Among them is Dr. Marwan Al-Hams, head of Abu Yusuf Al-Najjar Hospital. He was last seen 10 days ago when an Israeli undercover unit seized him at a field hospital of the International Committee of the Red Cross in Rafah.
Well, our next guest is a U.S.-based surgeon just back from Gaza, where she treated patients at Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis, where she says malnutrition cases are everywhere, in newborn babies, pregnant women, even among the hospital staff. Dr. Amreen Slimi is a urogynecologist who is the executive director of the International Medical Response Foundation, based here in New York City. Has provided medical services in numerous countries, including Pakistan, Nigeria, and Ukraine. She's joining us here in New York. Thanks so much, doctor, for joining us. You are just back this week from Gaza. Talk about what you found on the ground and the evidence that the Prime Minister of Israel is denying that there is starvation in Gaza.
Good morning. Thank you for having me here in New York. I just got back 2 days ago. And I spent about 3.5 weeks there, and primarily in the maternity hospital on the grounds of Nasser Hospital. And it was evident to me in my firsthand experience that what I was seeing was malnourishment in my patients, which were pregnant patients, but also those needing gynecologic care. And it was evident by the numbers of babies and their birth weight that was coming out, that they were being born to malnourished women. It was evident in the decreased ability to breastfeed when the newborns were born by the moms. And also in the way that pregnancies had complications that had increased in number, and remarkably so in the last few months of the siege. So there was ample evidence, just clinically by, you know, numbers in cases of complications, by birth weights of babies, by preterm babies, and also just being able to look at our patients, you know, to see bones that normally we wouldn't see. And we also saw it in our hospital staff, because not only were those being taken care of in a hospital starving with lack of access to good, nutritious food on a regular basis, but also the caregivers were also feeling the same lack of food, feeling the same hunger pains. And it was openly discussed, because everybody would sit and talk about how hungry they were in the break room, and when they were leaving, that they had to go now and find food for their families. So, you know, I think it was very clear in my experience and those I was working with that this was really a starvation crisis that was occurring.
And Dr. Slimi, you spent most of your time there in operating rooms. If you could talk about the intersection, the pregnant women that you dealt with who were also suffering from traumatic injuries,
yeah.
What were the principal things that you were treating and the surgeries you were performing?
I'm really glad you asked that, because I think when we talk about pregnancy in a war zone, we really need to address the issue of trauma in pregnant patients. And actually, just before coming here, I found out that one of our pregnant patients who was in the ICU had passed away yesterday. And she was 5 months pregnant and sleeping in a tent, and a bomb was dropped in the area that's supposed to be a safe zone. So she ended up coming in with, extensive burns and explosive injuries with shrapnel, and required major surgery for the burns with skin grafts, major surgery, abdominal surgery to get rid of the shrapnel. She had lost vision in one eye, and she was intubated. She couldn't breathe on her own because of inhalation from the smoke and fire. So there was a thought that she would be able to pull through. Oh, and by the way, she was also 5 months pregnant, which was really hard to even notice because she was so malnourished. So I, you know, was consulted to come in and at least do an ultrasound and make sure that the baby was alive. And before I left, it was. And so I just found out yesterday, as I was checking up on her, I found out this morning that she had passed away. And there's always hope that somebody will pull through. But the situations with the sanitation, In Nasser Hospital, we also just heard as we were leaving on Monday morning that the clinical wound services for over 400 patients had to be suspended because the supplies had run out. So we're already dealing with, you know, malnutrition and starvation because of the Israeli siege on food and supplies, affecting healing on a heavily traumatized patient population, including pregnant women. And now the services that were going to be withheld were the one thing that could get them to some healing with appropriate wound care.
I wanted to play for you the Israeli ambassador to the U.S., Yechiel Leiter, who claimed that the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was flooding food into Gaza. As we know, Netanyahu has denied outright that there's starvation in Gaza. This is the Israeli ambassador.
We feel the same way. The Prime Minister feels the same way, and that's why he's taken every decision possible to have food flood into Gaza. As a matter of fact, right now as we speak, there's 636 trucks, semi-trailers, waiting to enter Gaza, and the UN agencies are not picking them up because of their argument with the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. I appeal to the international community, to the media.